This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Michael Feinstein, has written a new book called The Gershwins and Me, A Personal History in 12 Songs. Before Feinstein became famous for performing American popular song, he had the privilege of working closely with Ira Gershwin as his archivist and cataloger during the last 6 years of Ira's life. Feinstein had access to rare Gershwin recordings and discovered unpublished music. Ira died in 1983, long outliving his brother and songwriting partner George, who died in 1937. Feinstein's new book comes with a CD of Feinstein performing the 12 songs that are at the center of the book. Terry spoke with Feinstein last Wednesday, and they began with his favorite recording of the George and Ira Gershwin song Fascinating Rhythm, featuring George Gershwin at the piano, accompanying Fred and Adele Astaire, recorded in 1926.
There's a little rhythm, 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 the pitter pat through my brain. So darn persistent, the day is distant, but it'll drive me insane.
Up in the morning without any warning, and hangs around me all day.
Someday I'll speak up to it, someday I'll speak up to it. I hope it listens.
Michael Feinstein, welcome back to Fresh Air, and thank you so much for choosing some great recordings for us to listen to today. Why is the Fred and Adele Astaire version with Gershwin at the piano your favorite version of Fascinating Rhythm?
It's my favorite because it has a kind of energy and a snap and essence of the 20s that has gotten lost with that song through the decades. It is so live and in the moment and energetic and recreates in my mind what it must have been like to be in the room with Fred and Adele and George at the piano. I think it's just an incredible document.
So the story behind the song, you actually filled in some of the blanks of the story behind the song because you found a draft, a really early draft of Fascinating Rhythm. How did you find it and what did you find?
In 1982, there turned up in Secaucus, New Jersey, at the Warner Brothers Music Warehouse, which is the place where Warner's kept all of their stock of their published music that they would sell, suddenly somebody who was working in that warehouse, a guy named Henry Cohen, found these boxes and boxes of music that looked like manuscript material of not only George Gershwin, but of Victor Herbert and Leonard Bernstein and Arthur Schwartz and Cole Porter and Vincent Humans and on and on and on. And we were called, we being Ira Gershwin, for whom I worked in 1982. He was, 83 or 84 at that point. And they said, there are these manuscripts of George's here and lyric sheets of yours, and somebody better come and look at them. And Ira said, oh, no, that stuff was destroyed long ago. That's a mistake. So he sent me to look and see what was there, only because of the insistence of the folks in New Jersey, even though Ira was convinced that we would find nothing. And it turns out that I found, amongst all these boxes, 87 original manuscripts in George Gershwin's hand, plus copies of scores that had been lost for 50 and 60 years. For some reason, they were all there, and it turned out to be one of the greatest musical theater discoveries of the century.
So what did you learn about the early version of Fascinating Rhythm?
One of the things I learned was that it had another title, which was Syncopated City, which was the dummy or working title that George had appended to that tune. So it told me that he wrote the song as something that was inspired by the city of New York, by the energy of Manhattan. And it also contained a little passage that George plays on that 1926 recording that we just listened to. It's a little interlude that he plays on that recording that no one knew what it was, and there it is in his hand, written out. So it must have been part of the dance music that Fred and Adele danced to in 1924.
You know, and you have another interesting story about Fascinating Rhythm, which is that George Gershwin told Ira Gershwin that the last two syllables of certain lines in the song had to be two-syllable words. Would you explain why?
Whenever George would come up with a tune, there was a certain way that the words would have to fall on the tune. Ira preferred to write to a melody, but that meant that the words had to be fitted like a suit with a tailor, so there was not an accent, as Frank Lesser would say, on the wrong syllable. And so that's we put the accent upon the wrong syllable and we sing a tropical song. So George wanted to make sure that there had to be a word that made sense that was accented at the end of those phrases. So Ira came up with fascinating rhythm. You've got me on the go, fascinating rhythm. I'm all the quiver. And those words that came at the end of the phrase were the ones that had to be the more important part of what the statement would be lyrically. And so it's really the opposite of the way something is usually expressed musically.
So I want to play another song that you've brought with you. And we asked Michael Feinstein to bring some of his favorite Gershwin recordings and some rarities. And this is a song I want to talk with you about. So this is a Peggy Lee recording of The Man I Love, one of the Gershwin's great songs, with Nelson Riddle's orchestra, recorded in 1957. So before we talk about the song, tell us why you love this version of it.
The Man I Love has almost become a cliché in the sense that the song has been heard and performed so many times that it becomes harder and harder as time progresses for a singer to perform the song with great sincerity, one of the reasons being that the song is something that lyrically could be considered maudlin in these days because it's the quintessential torch song, someday he'll come along, that man, he'll come for me. So it takes a really great interpreter to be able to take a lyric that borders now on cliché because it was written in a particular time and to make it absolutely immediate and fresh and make it believable. And Peggy Lee, who recorded the song 3 decades after it was written, sings the song with such connection, sincerity, and simplicity. And, of course, Nelson Riddle's arrangement is one that is supreme in its majesty.
It's really beautiful. Let's hear it. So this is Peggy Lee, 1957, The Man I Love.
Someday he'll come along, the man I love. And he'll be big and strong, the man I love. And when he comes my way, I'll do my best to make him stay. He'll look at me and
Peggy Lee with the Nelson Riddle Orchestra, recorded in 1957, the George and Ira Gershwin song, The Man I Love. It's one of the recordings chosen for us today by my guest, Michael Feinstein, who has a new book called The Gershwins and Me, A Personal History in 12 Songs. You also write in your book that there was a version of The Man I Love that Ira wrote that's The Girl I Love. And the lyric is different.
Yes.
He didn't just like substitute man and girl. The lyrics changed. Can you describe how the lyric was changed? And why?
Yes, The Man I Love is a song that was thrown out of 3 of the Gershwins' musicals. The first show it was deleted from was Lady Be Good, for which it was written, and it was introduced by Adele Astaire, and it slowed up the action of the show, and it was cut in Philadelphia after the first night, or the first couple of nights, depending on who you ask. Then George and Ira tried to put it into the 1927 version of a show called Strike Up the Band, and that show failed and closed out of town. But it was for the 1927 version of Strike Up the Band that they wrote a version called The Girl I Love, which was sung by Morton Downey Sr., who was a very popular, high-voiced Irish tenor. And Ira wrote a version that went, someday she'll come along, the girl I love, her smile will be a song, the girl I love. And the ending was, for her I'll do and dare as ne'er before, our hopes and dreams we'll share forevermore. And the show closed, the lyric, the male version was never published, and then the song eventually became popular on its own when it was picked up by Helen Morgan and became this great Gershwin standard. Well, many years later, when I was working for Ira, I found the lyric for The Girl I Love, and I showed it to him, And he said, oh, this isn't any good. And he immediately ripped it up. And I said, oh, no. But I thought I have to, you know, let the author have his way. And I didn't take it out of the wastebasket. I respected the fact that he didn't want it heard. He felt the song was so popular as The Man I Love, he didn't think it should be monkeyed with. And then shortly thereafter, a script for the 1927 version of Strike Up the Band turned up because the script was lost. And in it was, once again, the lyric for The Girl I Love. And when Ira looked at that script and saw the lyric, on that day, he said, hey, this isn't bad. And I said, oh, well, can I sing it? He said, sure. So that day he was in a different mood, and that's why the lyric was saved.
So which way do you usually like to sing it, The Man I Love or The Girl I Love?
It depends on the audience. You know, I have sung it both ways, and sometimes I play it instrumentally. When I first recorded it as The Girl I Love, I recounted in the notes of my first album a story of playing Ira a recording of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus singing The Man I Love. And at that time, it made Ira very uncomfortable, even though he had no prejudice or anything against gay rights, and he knew that I was gay. But he never expected to hear that song sung by a very masculine and robust chorus as The Man I Love. And I recounted that story in the notes of the album and got a very nasty note from a guy saying, how dare you, and I'll never listen to your music again, missing the point of what I was trying to express. But I do switch it around depending on how it feels.
Ira Gershwin, you said, was comfortable with gay people, but he just couldn't imagine the song being sung by a man to a man or by a woman to a woman.
No, he never conceived that, even though so many of his friends were gay. And George also was very matter-of-fact about it. In one letter he wrote to Ira, he was recounting he was at a party, and he said, Herbie Fields and his sweetheart, referring to Herbie Fields' boyfriend. So it was not an issue for them.
So actually, an issue you raise in the book, while we're on the subject, is whether George Gershwin was gay, because there was speculation about that. Who did the speculating?
Well, so many people speculated that George Gershwin was gay because he never got married. And somebody once said to Oscar Levant, you know, George is betting all those women because he's trying to prove he's a man. And Oscar Levant said, what a wonderful way to prove it. There have always been rumors circulating about George's sexuality, and I addressed it because so many people have asked me about it, and it's important to the gay community to identify famous personalities as being gay. In the case of George, it's all rather mysterious because I never encountered any man who claimed to have a relationship with George, but a lot of innuendo. Yet Simone said that she thought that Gershwin must be gay because when they were on a trip together, he never laid a hand on her, she said. Cecilia Eger, who was a very close friend of George's and whose husband, Milton Eger, was George's roommate, once at the dinner table said, well, of course, you know, George was gay. And Milton said, Cecilia, how can you say that? And she just looked at him and said, Milton, you don't know anything. but when I asked her about it, she wouldn't talk about it. So it still remains a mystery. My own theory is that I think that the thing that mattered most to George was his music. I think he could have been confused sexually. I don't know. I think that he had trouble forming a lasting relationship. Kitty Carlisle talked about how George asked her to marry him, but she said that she knew that he wasn't deeply in love with her. But she fit the demographic of what his mother felt would be the right woman for him.
Michael Feinstein speaking with Terry Gross last week. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air Weekend. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward reviews a newly released complete set of recordings from Roxy Music, a group he calls one of the strangest of the 70s. Also, Tyler Perry will talk about his recent turn as an action star in the new film Alex Cross, a big departure from his most popular character, Medea. And we'll hear more from Michael Feinstein. Thank you. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Michael Feinstein. Before he became famous for his performances of American popular song, he worked as Ira Gershwin's archivist during the last 6 years of his life. In Feinstein's new book, The Gershwins and Me, A Personal History in 12 Songs, he draws on his memories of Ira Gershwin and his knowledge of rare Gershwin recordings and unpublished music.
You know, I had started reading about Porgy and Bess when the revival that was recently on Broadway was staged. And you have some very interesting history about Porgy and Bess. Originally, George Gershwin wanted the Metropolitan Opera, to perform Porgy and Bess, but they would only do it with their white opera singers in blackface. And George Gershwin's reaction was?
No way, Jose. There was no way he was going to allow Porgy and Bess performed by whites in blackface, because he felt it was demeaning to the race, demeaning to the subject of the opera, and he felt that it would become a caricature. Even though he loved the voice of Lawrence Tibbett, and Lawrence Tibbett actually made the first commercial recordings of Porgy and Bess, supervised by George, and there was even talk later on, after George's death, of Tibbett doing it in blackface, but the family, Ira, actually put a stop to that. The point is that George had a very special feeling for Porgy and Bess, and he felt that it was his great masterwork, and he wanted to depict these characters in a way that was taken very seriously at a time when many people didn't want to know or see a work that consisted entirely of a all-African-American cast. It's a very volatile period in our history because it's 1935, it's the Depression, and when George undertook the writing of Porgy and Bess, everybody was against him. He was considered by some to be a Tin Pan Alley guy, and how could he have the nerve to try and write an opera? The classical world said, oh, this is absurd. Who does he think he is? The Jewish community was agog. Of course, the black community said, our own people should be writing about our race. Who is this guy to do it? I mean, everybody was against him, except he had this vision, and he had to fulfill it. And he absolutely believed in what he knew was inside of him, and that's what's so extraordinary. And even after it opened and it was financially a failure, he still maintained that it would one day be regarded as his greatest work. And, of course, he was right.
So the Metropolitan Opera wanted their singers to do it in blackface because they didn't believe they'd be able to find enough African-American singers to perform the show?
That's very true. Mm-hmm. That's true. That was one of the considerations. It wasn't the only one, because they also were concerned about the box office. But it's true that George had trouble finding the cast that he wanted, because Porgy and Bess is an odd amalgam of opera and Broadway. Some critics said that the songs were its greatest weakness, and other critics said that the songs were the best part of the work. And, of course, when it was revived in 1942 by Cheryl Crawford, it was done as a Broadway musical with dialogue and songs. They took out the recitative on which George had worked so hard.
There's a great story about how you got to know Ira Gershwin. And it's through your obsession with finding sheet music and recordings, like old recordings.
Yes.
So tell us the story of how you were, in your early 20s, when you came upon the collection that ultimately led you to Ira Gershwin?
I was 20 years old. I had moved to Los Angeles from Columbus, Ohio. I was collecting records, and I was looking for a particular recording by Oscar Levant, who was the greatest interpreter of Gershwin music. And I went into a record store in Hollywood, and I was shown this cache of recordings that had belonged to Oscar Levant, including private recordings of Gershwin that had never been released. I bought these records from the guy in this used record shop, who told me they came from the estate of Oscar Levant. I was working as a piano salesman, a terrible piano salesman. I couldn't sell them. I could demonstrate them, but people wouldn't buy them from me. And this lady I worked with gave me the phone number of Oscar's widow, June Levant. I called her up out of the blue. She invited me over because I told her I had these records that somehow had been carried out of her house, and she didn't know they were gone and wanted them back. She met me and realized that I had this passion for Oscar Levant's work and for George and Ira Gershwin's work, And we became friends, and she started introducing me to various people in Hollywood and eventually told Ira's wife Leonore about me when June and Lee had lunch. Lee Gershwin asked to meet me. I came over to the house, and I was suddenly sitting there with Ira Gershwin and with Lee, and they asked me to start working for them cataloging Ira's collection of phonograph records. So I was hired as a discographer for a job that I thought was only going to take several weeks or maybe a couple months at most. And it was during that time that I became very attached to Ira and he to me. It turns out that Ira was in a state of great depression because one of his close friends had passed away, and Ira was already reclusive and very sedentary, was not in great physical shape, and by asking him questions and playing these Gershwin recordings that I pulled out of the closet that went back to 1917, it brought him back. And suddenly he had this spark, and he seemed to be coming out of this depression. And one day I was sitting there and I was whistling. I was cataloging one of these records and writing down data about it, sitting behind Ira, who was in a swivel chair. And I was whistling a Gershwin tune. And Ira was reading the paper, and he swiveled around the chair with his feet and said, "Mike, that's the verse of Beginner's Luck." He said, "I wrote that with George in 1936 for Shall We Dance?" And I said, "I know." He said, "Well, how do you know that?" I said, "Well, I know a lot of your songs." He said, "You do?" I said, "Yes." And he started quizzing me, and he realized that this 20-year-old kid knew his catalog, knew his work. And then he asked me to play the piano for him, and I did. And he looked at me with this very odd expression, and he said something like, "How many more like you are out there?" And I suddenly realized that I was an anomaly. I was unusual, and I hadn't really put it together. But for Ira, he couldn't believe that this 20-year-old kid would have any interest at all in his work. And it revitalized him. It brought him back to life. And Lee Gershwin pulled me aside and said, "You've given my husband a new lease on life. I want you to stay in this house as long as you can." She said, "I know that you'll eventually go on to do other things, but I'm going to open up every closet and drawer, and I want you to just keep Ira occupied and stay busy and do what you can for him." So I was there for 6 years until his passing.
Michael Feinstein, thank you so much for coming to talk with us and for bringing some great recordings with you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Terry. I'm very grateful to be on your show.
Michael Feinstein speaking with Terry Gross last Wednesday. Feinstein's new book is called The Gershwins and Me. You can read an excerpt and hear the complete interview on our website, freshair.npr.org. One of the strangest groups of the 1970s was Britain's Roxy Music, whose scandalous album covers, odd sounds, and well-dressed lead singer Brian Ferry set them apart from the other bands of the era. EMI recently reissued their 8 studio albums, and rock historian Ed Ward has a review.
"I never thought I'd see you again. Where have you been until now?
Roxy Music's the only band I can think of that had an oboe player in it. And that's because the oboe player, Andy McKay, knew the manager of another band, King Crimson. An unemployed ceramics teacher, Brian Ferry, had auditioned for lead vocalist with them, and although he hadn't been selected, the manager thought McKay should meet him. As it happened, Ferry had been fired from his teaching job for singing in the classroom, songs he'd written, and McKay liked them enough to call his friend Brian Eno, who played keyboards and loved to mess around with electronic equipment, and they made a demo tape. This got them some gigs, and they added some more musicians, including guitarist Phil Manzanera. In mid-1972, they signed with King Crimson's label, EG, and in August released their first self-titled album. The British press went wild. They then put out a single that wasn't on the album. The British public went wild.
"Make me a deal and make it straight. Or sign and seal a ticket to Robert DiBiase. I hope that you don't blow it, cause we've been around a long time. Just try to play the big time."
Virginia Plain was a brilliant single, 3 minutes of shifting textures and driving beat, with space for Eno's twiddling and Manzanera's avant guitar playing. But although the band ended 1972 with an American tour, they were largely ignored there and came home to work on another album, For Your Pleasure. The cover photo showed a neon-lit urban landscape in front of which a woman in a tight black dress and spike heels walked a snarling black panther, while off to one side, her limo waited, chauffeured by a grinning Brian Ferry. It gave a hint of what was inside.
There's a new sensation, a fabulous creation, a danceable solution to teenage revolution. The strand love, when you feel love, it's the new way, and that's why we say, do the strand, do it on the tables.
Not only did the album have the hit Do the Strand, it also had loads of mysterious lyrics against an increasingly confident backup. By this time, Brian Eno wanted out, and one day the band showed up for rehearsal and found out he'd hired violinist keyboard player Eddie Jobson away from the band Curved Air to take his place. As it turned out, Jobson was a brilliant choice, and he added significantly to the next album, Stranded. The band was working hard to keep up its momentum, even though Ferry had released his first solo album, consisting of cover versions and a few originals in 1973. 1974 saw two Roxy albums, Stranded and Country Life, the latter of which had to be sold with opaque green shrink wrap in the U.S. because of its cover photo showing two women in revealing underwear standing in front of some bushes. And in 1975, with Ferry's solo career still going strong, the band released Siren, which featured his current girlfriend, Texas model Jerry Hall, as a blue-tinted mermaid on the cover, and one of the band's most famous tracks as the lead-off. Roxy Music had conquered the U.S. charts with the song Love is the Drug, but the band was exhausted, and in June 1976, they announced they were breaking up, at least for a while. It turned out to be quite a while, but in 1979, a new Roxy Music album appeared. Manifesto had a crowded disco scene on its cover, but the dancers seemed to be mostly mannequins. Undaunted, they were back a year later with Flesh and Blood, whose austere cover showing three blonde girls clad in white togas tossing javelins was as much of a change as what was inside, which included two oldies and a lovely pop tune, Oh Yeah.
How can we drive to a movie show when the music is here in my car? There's a
There was still stress. Ferry collapsed on tour and had to be hospitalized. Nothing more was heard from the band until the spring of 1981, when Ferry led the band in a moving tribute to John Lennon. No album followed immediately, but a year later the band called it a day with Avalon, which led off with a lovely single, More Than This, but was otherwise devoid of ideas. Ferry's continued to record as a solo, and many Roxy alumni, including, of course, Brian Eno, have gone on to make plenty of wonderful music.
Ed Ward reviewed Roxy Music, the complete studio recordings. Coming up, Tyler Perry talks about writing, directing, producing, and starring in some of the most successful films of the last decade. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
I could feel at the time there was no way of knowing falling leaves in the night. The kids say men are growing as free as the wind. Hopefully learning why the sea on the tide is no
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, supporter of the Cy Sims School of Business at Yeshiva University at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science, technology, and economics in the modern world. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, screenwriter, director, producer, and star Tyler Perry, grew up poor but has become a movie phenomenon, the most financially successful black man the American film industry has ever known, according to The New Yorker. He first developed his following on the African-American theater circuit. By the time he released his first movie in 2005, Diary of a Mad Black Woman, his following was so large the film premiered nationally at number one. Part drama, part comedy, it introduced his most popular character, Madea, to movie audiences. Madea, Mabel Simmons, is the matriarch of a family, and playing her requires Tyler Perry to completely transform himself. He's also shared scenes with himself, since he's also played Madea's brother and her nephew. Perry's other films include Madea's Family Reunion, The Family That Prays, and Why Did I Get Married? He's also had two very popular cable TV series, House of Pain and Meet the Browns. Tyler Perry fans who are used to seeing him in a floral housecoat as Madea are in for a surprise. He's starring in the new thriller Alex Cross as a police detective tracking down a sociopathic serial killer. Terry spoke with Perry last Monday and began with a clip from the movie. The killer, played by Matthew Fox, is calling Perry's character, Alex Cross, to taunt him after having killed Cross's wife.
Cross.
Good afternoon, detective. Am I calling at a bad time?
That depends. Are you calling to tell me where you are so I can hunt you down like a rabid dog?
Oh, that's good. I can feel that. I mean, you look so numb at the funeral today. But now the pain's really starting to flow, isn't it?
Here's another emotion for you. It's pleasure. The pleasure I'm gonna get when I watch your soul come oozing out of your body, you maggot.
Well, Confucius said, when setting off on the path of revenge, dig two graves.
That's fine with me, as long as you're in one of them.
Tyler Perry, welcome to Fresh Air. So this is the first time that I know of that you're in a movie that you didn't make yourself. So it must have been odd for you to be in a movie where you didn't write it, you're not directing it. I know you've been in movies that you haven't directed, but you've written them. So what was it like to not be in total control?
Oh, I rather enjoyed it, actually. This was a release for me. The first film that I did was Star Trek. I did a very small role in that because I hadn't been on anyone else's set, and I wanted to see how it went. So I spent time with J.J. Abrams on that, which I thought was great. So that let me know that I could do it. That was my little test for that. And for Alex Cross, this was a welcome vacation because it was great to just focus on the performance, to take every bit of energy that usually has to be divided into a million different areas into just acting. That was really wonderful and profound for me.
So let me ask you about your own movies, the ones that you make yourself. You often play three parts. Medea, who is an aunt to many of the characters in the movie, her brother, Joe, and Joe's son, who you also play, who is a lawyer. So let's talk a little bit about these parts. Let's start with Medea, who's your most famous character. Again, she's not in all your movies, but she's your most famous character. Why don't you describe her and how you created her?
You know, Medea is a cross between my mother and my aunt, and watching Eddie Murphy, the brilliant Eddie Murphy, do the clumps, I thought, man, maybe I should try my hand at a female character, and that's what came up. I thought I'd imitate the funniest people that I know, and she is exactly the PG version of my mother and my aunt, and I loved having an opportunity to pay homage to them. She's a strong, witty, loving. I'm really just like my mother used to be before she died. She would beat the hell out of you, but make sure the ambulance got there on time to make sure they could set your arm back. You know what I mean? Because the love was there inside of all of it. I know it sounds really strange, but that's that old school mentality that's why I think the character is so popular, because a lot of people miss that type of grandmother. Everybody's so worried about being politically correct that she's no longer around.
No, Medea in your movies wears these like loose fitting house coats, these like big 80s style glasses. Can you talk about how you dress her? Do you pick the clothes yourself?
No, it's all my wardrobe department, but I just, as long as they know I don't want her to be sexy, I'm fine with it.
She's not going to be.
No, I just can't imagine being.
You don't have to worry.
Trying to be sexy. That's just a little bit too much for my senses to take on.
Okay, so let's talk about Medea's brother, Joe, who lives with her. He's kind of the opposite of her in a lot of ways. Describe him.
He's a cantankerous old fart who's always thinking about sex, and he's not politically correct either. He's just from the old school. He's always looking for drugs. He always wants to smoke pot and has nothing wise to say. He is strictly there for the comic relief.
And describe the character of Brian, the lawyer who is the nephew of Medea.
Yeah, Brian would be the nephew of Medea who's shown up in a couple of my movies. And his purpose for me was just to see if I could just do a straight role, because it's so easy for me to have a costume and hide behind that costume. So for him, he was the most challenging and the most uncomfortable for me because I had nothing to hide behind. So he was my beginning, the beginnings of understanding or knowing, could I, or trying to see if I could do something outside of having a costume.
So now we're going to bring all three of those characters together in a scene. And this is from Medea's family reunion. Medea is always having to go to court for some reason or another. It's usually something like horrible she's done to defend someone in her family. But her offense this time around is that she took off her house arrest bracelet. And representing her is Brian, one of your other characters. So you're both mm-hmm. You've just been before the judge, and the judge has sentenced Medea to be a foster parent for this kid who's really troubled, who needs a home. And the judge figures the one thing Medea's really good at is, you know, protecting kids and protecting her family, so I'm going to give her this kid. So you and Medea have just driven back to Medea's house. Joe is waiting there on the steps. Joe sees Medea and this new kid. So Joe speaks first, and so here, to sum up, here's my guest Tyler Perry in three roles from his movie Medea's Family Reunion.
I was sure hoping they would have locked you the hell up.
The only thing locked up around here is your bowels. Now shut the hell up.
How you doing, Daddy? Hey, Brian. Hey, Tiffany, how you doing?
Daddy, this is not my daughter.
Oh, well, here, they all look alike to me. Who is for?
Medea is a new foster mother. You're going to have a house guest.
That child ain't staying here. You can't stay here. Go on back to where the hell you came from. You can't stay up in this house. That bad enough you let that gal move up in here with them two babies making all that racket all day long. Now you done bought her here. Every time I send you somewhere, you come back with something. Take it back. We don't want it. Return to sender.
I remember I sent you somewhere, too, and you came back with something. You still itching?
Your mama. Oh, hell, that's my mama, too, ain't it?
Don't say nothing like that in front of this child. Come on in the house. I'll show you where you're sleeping.
Daddy, you got to stop being so mean.
I wish I had been mean to your mama, then I wouldn't be sitting here looking at you right now. I tell you, that's crazy as hell. All these people up in this house. I'm going to call the fire marshal. That is against the law. Oh, I'm going to need some weed to be dealing with all these people up here. These babies crying every 5 minutes.
So that was Tyler Perry, in a scene from his movie Medea's Family Reunion. So the father in this movie, Joe, is based in part on your father, right?
And more on my grandfather. My grandfather was a man, my mother's father, who his name was Willie, and he owned a juke joint in rural Louisiana. And we would spend times there the summers at his house, and his house was 10 feet from a train track, so the train would come through all the time. And he was just a great, great character who kept a straight razor in his back pocket and always had an apple and a cigar. He was just a great guy.
Yeah, I'm thinking because, like, your father was not a comic character by any means, and I thought it would be hard to transform him into one because it sounds like he spent a lot of his time beating you when you were growing up.
He was what I know about my father is this, and what I've tried to learn over the years is this, that his story is it's very interesting too. And what I tell lots of people who are angry with their parents or children who've grown up and become older men or women, and they're trying to understand or get to a place of forgiveness, as I had to get to with my father, the thing that helped me the most was understanding who he was as a child. The man was found, my aunt and my uncle, I think my aunt was 6, my uncle was 4, and he was 2, and they were all in this drainage canal, and they were found by a white man who saw the kids and brought them to a woman named May to raise, who lived on some of the property that the white man owned. I don't know the man's name, but it's possibly Perry, because we don't know where Perry came from. But anyway, he left the children there with her, and she was 14 years old. And her father was a former slave and a very old man who was bedridden at the time, very old and dying. And everything that she knew to do was to beat the children. So everything my father did, whatever he did wrong, was she would beat him. She was 14 years old. She would put him in a potato sack, tie him in a tree, and she would beat him for everything that he did wrong. So that is what he came out of. And understanding who he was helped me to be able to forgive a lot of his behavior and what he tried to pass on to me. It doesn't excuse it, but it gave me an opportunity to understand who he was. So in all fairness to him, now I have a clearer picture of who he was.
How old were you when you reached that point of feeling like you could at least understand, if not forgive, his behavior?
I think at 28, I didn't find out a lot of this stuff until I was in my 30s, but at 28, I started on the path of letting go. Because what I realize is what I like for a lot of people to realize. If you're holding on to the anger and the pain of what someone has done to you, you are not hurting them at all. You are hurting yourself.
But anger, it seems like anger was a very powerful fuel for you, because you probably worked off the fumes of anger for a long time and in pushing yourself as hard as you did to get to where you got to.
Absolutely, as do a lot of people who were abused. So the anger was the fuel, but what happens, and this is why a lot of people don't want to let go of the anger. This is why I didn't want to let go of the anger. I wasn't aware of it then, but I know now looking back on it, because the anger was the fuel. And once I forgave him, I was no longer angry. So I lost the motivation and I lost the fuel. Because the fuel was, I'll prove you wrong. I am worth something. I am better than what you're saying I am. You know, and once all of that was gone and none of that mattered anymore, I had to find another source of fuel. And that is where I came up with all of these characters in the movies and the place that I'm in my life now with everything that I write and produce and direct it. I want it rooted in positivity.
We've talked a little bit about your mother and your father and how your father used to beat you and how he was beaten when he was a child. Did your mother try to protect you from his beatings, or was she as much a victim as you were?
As best she could. I think you have to, again, it goes back to the story, and you have to understand who she was. You know, her mother died when she was 13 years old. She had five brothers and sisters, and she was a middle child. And my father came along and married her when she was 17, brought her down to New Orleans, and they had nowhere to live and nowhere to stay. So she had never known how to support or take care of herself. And every time she would go to one of her aunts or people in her family, they would tell her that he's a good man, he has a job, you stay with him. And that was her experience in life, and that is what she was taught, and that is what she knew. So she did the absolute best that she could with the situation that she was given.
Your mother stayed with your father in spite of, you know, how he could be brutal. Did you want them to separate? Were you hoping that she would leave him and take you with her?
Many times. And she did once or twice. But what was clear about it is that she had no way to support four children. And as bad as things were, as bad of a person as he could be, the man was a provider. He provided. The lights were never off. You know, we didn't have everything we wanted, but everything we needed was definitely met.
Several of the movies that you've made are very much from a woman's point of view, about women's relationship with friends, family, boyfriends, husbands, children. And I'm interested in why some of your films are largely from a woman's perspective.
As a child, my father, who was there in the house, he wasn't at all a role model. And my mother, who was trying to protect me from him as best she could, she took me everywhere with her, which gave me a tremendous amount of sensitivity to the things that women go through. I would spend more time at the laundromat in Lane Bryant than any young boy should.
But Lane Bryant's for large women.
yeah, Lane Bryant for large women. But it taught me a lot about women and their issues and being there in the house with her and my sisters. So a lot of times I'm speaking from the little boy who's at her apron, looking up at the world and seeing all that I'm seeing these women go through. You know, it was fascinating, powerful, hurtful, dark at times, but there was always hope. And my mother would always take me to church. She would always, that's where I say this a lot. I said she didn't have much to give me, but she gave me Jesus. So I owe a tremendous amount of debt to them and to her and to all the women that were in my life. And I'm hoping that in a lot of my work, I was hoping that I was speaking to my own mother. And I'm hoping that somebody who sees the movie, and this is what motivates me and moves me, as people see my films, to get the thousands of letters that I get on of people who were moved and inspired and left abusive relationships because of something they saw. These are people who can't afford therapy for the most part, who've never had it, who don't understand why they're in this situation. And here I am with this very simple but complex mirror in front of them and they're able to say, wow, that's me. Well, what if I did that? You know, that's what makes it worthwhile for me.
Can I just ask you about money? When you started making money, which is something you never had, and it was something that you lost everything you had on your first production, what were your dreams of what to do with your money? Was it to, you know, just like reinvest it into more of your work, or were there like material possessions that you really wanted?
I had one dream, and it was to, when I was a kid, I told my mother I would take care of her so she wouldn't have to deal with my father. And I didn't know how much of a driving force that was until she died. That had been the burning fire in the pit of my soul for many, many years. So, and I never thought any amount was enough. So that was my motivational factor, just to be able to support and take care of her and give her the life that she's always, I felt that she deserved and I should have always had.
When did she die?
2009, December 8th, 2009.
So you were already very successful then.
Yeah, she had an opportunity to see me do a lot of great things.
And with all the money that you probably gave her, she didn't use it to leave your father, which had been, you said, one of your goals.
Yeah, no, and she never would. And here's the thing, she never asked me for money. She never, it was so bizarre. Everything I did for her is, I, you know, was a gift, because she never, she wanted me to have and just be happy. But yeah, no, she never left him and couldn't imagine. And what I realized about her is my mother's heart only beat in one direction, and that's love, which is very rare for a person. I mean, she only knew how to love. And as I think back on my childhood and my life, I look back at how I remember sitting in the car, barely able to see over the dashboard of her out in the streets trying to get a bird that had broken its wing, you know, or moments like that, or waking up and there was always a stranger in the house. And I'm going, who is this person? She was always letting people come and stay and have shelter and food.
Well, Tyler Perry, thank you so much for talking with us.
This has been my pleasure.
Tyler Perry speaking with Terry Gross last Monday. Perry stars in the new thriller, Alex Cross. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world on the web at hewlett.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, supporter of the Cy Sims School of Business at Yeshiva University, at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.